And welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your host, Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice. And that, of course, was going out to all of my Gaelic ancestors, family, and all of you who are here today to broaden yourselves and to be part of the movement to reclaim our nations and our lives. We're here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, on the BBS network. Follow our work, murderbydecree.com and republicofkanata.ca. Well, I thought it was appropriate to start that today. Our theme is resistance to tyranny, tactics, strategies, and soul power. With me, of course, is my co-host Deb Golding and a guest, Susan Stanfield. We'll bring her on in a few minutes. I'll tell you a little bit about her. It's July 12th, and it's 200 years ago today, not today, this month, that my ancestors arrived in Canada. That's on my mom's side. The Mikuits arrived from the Highlands, actually the border between the Lowlands and the Highlands, driven out, of course, by the British, and landed in the Red River Settlement around Winnipeg 200 years ago, 1820. Well, interestingly enough, that's the same year my father's family arrived in Canada, in Ontario, the Annetts in southwest Ontario. So I'm commemorating them now and this year. Seventh generation, carry it on. A few announcements before I bring on our guests and my co-host Deb. And this is something you can also follow at our new website, republicofkanata.ca. Look under upcoming events. We have a number of important things. The two that are flagged on the website are two rallies, Take Back the Nation rallies. The main one happening in Parliament Hill in Ottawa, Wednesday, August 5th at 12:30 p.m. There's going to be a flag raising, a reading of the Proclamation of Independence from the Crown, speeches, music, and joyful defiance. And so we hope you'll all gather there in the nation's so-called capital, the start of a new nation, Wednesday, August 5th in Ottawa, 12:30 p.m. on Parliament Hill. A few days later in Toronto, the Toronto section of the Republic will be holding a public info and organizing meeting. That's Saturday, August 8th in Toronto, 3456 Yonge Street in Toronto. Free admission, bring a friend and learn about the new Republic. Also, on August 25th, that's a week this Saturday, on Vancouver Island, the Mid-Vancouver Island Republic of Canada section is holding their first common law training workshop. That's going to be Saturday, August the 25th at noon. It's going to be in the Duncan area. If you want more information about the details, write to republicofkanata@gmail.com if you're in the Mid-Vancouver Island area. And finally, on August 7th, that's the same week the other events are happening in Ottawa, Toronto, in the area around Picton and Belleville in South Central Ontario, there's going to be another common law training workshop by the Republic section there. That's Friday, August the 7th, and that's going to be at 2 in the afternoon. Again, write to republicofkanata@gmail.com if you're a patriot living in the South Central Ontario area. Now, without further ado, hello, Deborah. Are you there?
I'm here. Can you
good.
Hear me?
Well, excellent. I can hear you. There's a little bit of a stall there, but we're good. And I'm really quite interested about what we're going to be talking about today. Of course, we've got Susan Stanfield on as our guest for the first 20 minutes till the bottom of the hour. And she's somebody who's interviewed me. She's actually an activist in Vancouver, Canada. And she describes herself as a justice designer, a photographer, and a TV producer. She had a really interesting experience where she was actually thrown out of the Vancouver Yacht Club, fairly prestigious club, because she wouldn't put on a mask. And we're going to talk to her in a few minutes about that experience and what she's doing in response. I wanted to ask you, like in the few minutes before that, people have been saying, you know, you can get out of wearing these masks by just saying, I'm medically exempt. And in some places that's worked, but have you had any, experience of that in Salt Lake City? Like, are people defying it, or what's the mood about that where you are?
Oh, wow. There is a mood, and it seems to, there's three sections, you know. There's those that are very, very compliant, those that are raising their fists saying, don't take my rights away. And then I've noticed in some of the groups that I have, people that I know pretty well, there's some sensibility to it. I had a girlfriend actually just recently. She and I actually went to a restaurant that happened to be open, and neither of us walked in with masks. And it wasn't really, you know, like there wasn't a pushback with it, although there were signs around and stuff. So it's kind of there is a gentleness, but then not, because there's other stores that are like, you cannot come in here without a mask. So there was that version. And then the other day I went into another store, walked in to get whatever I was after, and the gentleman behind the counter is like, you know, he was very smooth about it. It was very, very smooth. Hey, do you have a mask? And I said, no, I don't. And he said, well, I have one here for you. And so it's been interesting to see how really it's still the public shaming on both sides of, you're not going to take my rights away. There's no way I'm going to do this. And the, how dare you endanger all of us? And
right.
It's been a very
that
interesting dynamic that goes, that's what's so frustrating to me is
right.
People aren't really seeing the polarization, but it is super polar. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting because a friend of mine in Winnipeg, he loves to turn things around. So what he did, he said, okay, I'll wear a mask, but on the mask, this black mask, he's written in white, so it stands out, COVID is a scam. Okay, mm-hmm. So he's walking around with the message and kind of mocking the wearing of the mask at the same time. So it's kind of like, I remember George Bernard Shaw, the English writer, said, the way you bring down the powerful and the mighty is to laugh at them because they have no defense to being mocked. And I think we should remember that. Use humor all the time with this stuff, right?
Well, I want to share something, and you just brought something up. The probably the funniest one that I've seen was actually my son was walking into the grocery store, and he had taken a flour tortilla and used that as a mask, and just said he needed to come in and get more tortillas because they were actually going to be. But I was just kind of. This was about 2 months ago when it was really, and I was kind of dumbfounded, like, what in the world are you doing? And it was just hilarious because people were looking at him like, what is, you're complying, but it's, you put a tortilla over your face. You know, it was just really, really quite funny. I mean, so you're bringing up humor, and I think it is. There are ways that we can actually, you know, okay. Really find that humor, find some balance in this, I think. But.
Right, exactly. Well, apparently Sue is with us, so let's bring her on. Hi, Sue, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing well, thanks. I'm outside at the beach, surrounded by thousands
Excellent.
Of people.
Far out. That's really good news. And I hope they're not sitting 6 feet apart.
No, because it's Kitsilano, and I think this is one of the more kind of irreverent or health-focused communities,
right.
And this is the place you want to be under these circumstances.
Well, we were just kind of joking about the ways we can turn this whole thing, mask thing around, like write a slogan on the mask, you know, COVID is a scam, whatever. But tell us your experience, what happened recently to you and what you're doing about it.
Okay, so there's lots of them. Are you talking about the sailing center?
Well, yeah, I'm talking about, first of all, where you were turned away. Oh, absolutely. No, I want you to talk about everything, you know, related to this and the protests you've been helping to lead and all that. But let's start with that.
Okay. Well, suffice to say, I'm a real operative. I've lived in Africa for a long time, and so I'm not an easy target when someone's trying to violate my rights. Like, I'm very cunning what I do and how I move through the world. So it's really rare that someone like me gets caught in this kind of situation. And I was essentially escorted, well, I was escorted off property and had a gate closed behind me. And everybody was staring. My children were, you know, mortified. It was the level of how I was dealt with was so much higher than was necessary. And the building was unique in that it's a public facility that you can enter, but there are memberships for people who can just do certain things that are sailing members. And then upstairs where I was headed is a private restaurant. So I had to kind of go through three different sort of jurisdictions in a way, you know, that would have three different protocols and three different managers and three different boards of directors. So it's a very unusual situation. And now, as you said, the last time we spoke, I'm in the process of claiming my human rights because through a process of complaint, because they don't just exist there. We actually have to exercise them. And if you're not exercising them, you're not demanding them, then God knows who's going to take them away or violate them. I think that's a big wake-up call for everybody, is that they don't just exist. We actually have to exercise them, and Canadians aren't used to this.
No. And so I know that, tell us, first of all, where things stand with that. Have you made a formal complaint somewhere, or what's going on with that?
Well, I'm being ignored, which is typical, and I guess most people would give up. I'm not going to give up, but I'm not in a rush either, so I'm just doing this when I have time. But I have to figure, I've never had this happen before, and I care enough because I live here. I've been in lots of countries like Africa and worked all over there where human rights violations are a day-to-day living circumstance, and I would never complain. You know, you just sort of take it. But for this to happen to me by my home in Kitsilano in Vancouver, kind of, I felt like I should do something about it. So I'm in this deep learning curve is, okay, I have to make a demand. If I'm going to file a complaint, they have to respond to something. If they go, okay, thanks for your complaint, goodbye, that's not really satisfying enough. So this is what I'm trying to figure out is, okay, it's like kidnapping. What's my ransom? I have to demand them to do something. Do I want an apology? Do I want a free dinner? Do I want $1 million? Like, you have to put something on the table, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so then thing is like, how's that work?
You were escorted out, right? Did they put their hands on you and pulled you out, or how did that happen?
No, they didn't. But they were so so firm and so aggressive in how they spoke to me that I thought, okay, well, it's putting the younger junior staff who were standing behind the food area, who I was trying to get a burger from, in a very awkward situation, which I don't like doing, because I said, I want my dinner. And she looked at her supervisor, and the supervisor's like, no, you're not serving this woman. So there was no kind of, okay, listen, why don't you come over here? Let's have a, you're obviously a local resident. Let's have a conversation about this. There was none of that. It immediately went to this, you are not going to get away with this. You are out of here. And I was really surprised. In my neighborhood, it's not like I'm in some community where I would expect that kind of hostility. And for me, it's
like they were making
unacceptable.
Like they were making an example of you. Almost.
Yeah, and you know what? And this is, I think, a really important part for advocates like us is they took offense to the fact that I was standing up for my rights. And there was no, oh, okay, right, you have a right, you're standing up for your right, good for you. Okay, let's figure this out. There was none of that. This was it was like a road rage moment. It was like, oh, yeah, you think you're going to stand up for your rights? Well, I'm going to punish you for that. And that's the circumstance that we live under now. There's no dialogue, there's no conciliation,
right.
There's no and so we have to lead society back to that. We have to get back to critical debate and away from this cancel culture, because we'll never make inroads.
That's a very important point. I want to ask my co-host Deb if she has any questions for you, but I do want to ask you to talk about the other actions you've been leading. Deb, do you have anything?
You know, I just found it very interesting that the learning curve is actually taught the fact that you need to do more than just say, hey, I'm not okay with this, but you actually need to have a demand. You need to have something that, what do you want from this? I mean, that's actually very mindful, and I appreciate that is where this is going. In fact, that is teaching me something right here, so I'm fascinated by this conversation.
Okay, well, let me tell you the final little bit. So I was ignored through the email process. So I phone up. I talk to the young girl that's working at the sailing center, right? Like, it's the nicest little place. It's a very old icon in Vancouver. And I'm like, can I have the name of the chairman of the board? So I go right to the top, and that's where you get the most impact. And she's like, okay, can I ask who's calling? So suddenly everybody gets nervous when as soon as you start talking about justice, everybody gets nervous as opposed to everybody coming to the table with their best ethics and their best morals, right? And I said, you don't have to give me his contact. I understand you're a young person answering the phone, but can you please just tell me his name? Because it's not on the website. And she gave me the name. So now I've got the chairman of the board, and it's a pretty powerful group of people. And I grew up with all these people, you know, yachty sailing people in Vancouver. So I have to, if he gets me on the, if I talk to him or meet with him, he's going to say, okay, well, what do you want from us? That's when I realized I better have something that I want. If he says, fine, you can have it. We apologize. Is that enough? Do you just want to apologize? And I think that's where, you know, it's a bigger, more egregious situation, like somebody stole something or broke something or put me in jail is different. But if somebody just, you know, is verbally insulting and denies you something and moves you off property, it's kind of this gray area.
Well, of course, they did assault you, and they put your children in fear of what was going on to you. So that is all assault under the law.
Yeah, so if he says to me, okay, fine, yep, that all happened, we understand, that really was, and I get the meeting, I get everything I want, right? And they're going to look at me at the table and they go, okay, we acknowledge that happened to you. It's not going to be, they're not going to offer something to me. I'm going to have to demand something. So I've actually come up with my demand, which they probably won't do. I want a public apology in a printed Vancouver newspaper saying what happened to me so the public can learn from this. They probably won't do that. And I want basically the dinner. And I'll be fine.
Right.
But more than that, I want to create something that other people can learn from and other people can use as a tool, because I was really caught off guard.
Now, the Vancouver Yacht Club is like pretty prestigious, and they obviously, their Achilles heel is they don't want a bad public image. So I think you kind of have them by the knackers in a way if you went public.
Yeah, and just so you know, it's not the Royal Vancouver Yacht Club. It's the Jericho Sailing Center, which is the poor cousin down the road a bit. And it is a public facility.
Place.
The land is on federal land, so it's a different beast. But you're right. It is still, it's an icon. Everybody knows about it. They don't want any bad media. And so I'm also tasked with this, okay, I want to come across as being very respected by the group and not like, oh, what a nightmare she was. You know, I want them to go, wow, okay, we did something that was wrong. Mm-hmm. And thank you, Susan, for walking through this process with us, because that's what we always should be wanting for as advocates, right?
Yeah,
so I'm just going
ground.
Through the motions to learn. Yeah. The other stuff I'm doing is much more high level and not sort of an individual experience of rights violations, but has to do with the BC legislature and the actual emergency orders and laws that are being made. That's a whole other world of, oh my God, how does this world work? Nobody teaches us.
Tell us
about
that. Tell us about some of these statutes.
Okay, well, since I have studied the corruption of the infectious disease industry for 2 years, when the first corona announcements came out, I knew this was a scam, because this is their business model, is to terrify people and then vaccinate them. And I was like, oh God. And I thought it was going to be quite minor. But as soon as I started seeing the TV stuff, and I'm also a TV producer, and I studied politics and television as a double major at Queen's, so I can see it before other people do. You know, I know what's happening. It's my world. It's my language. So I emailed John Horgan thinking, okay, this is you have to follow, you can get success by following protocol. I emailed his office and said, this is wrong. I'm on to you.
This is
corrupt.
That's the premier of British Columbia, for people to know. Yeah. Okay.
Because I'm sitting at home, and we've lost all of our income, and I'm like, what am I going to do? Well, I better start reaching out, because that's how you advocate, right? So I made this complaint letter saying, I demand a meeting, whatever, this is wrong. You can't close the schools. I emailed the school head, the Minister of Education, the superintendent, saying, do not close the schools. Keep the schools open. Allow choice. Let herd immunity to be built. All these things that I knew. Nobody responded to me. And then we went into this gulch for 6 weeks of just awfulness, right? Well, I get a reply email from John Horgan's office at David Ebby, who is my MLA and the Attorney General, and he's essentially instructing me how to sue the government, because I had complained that these were rights violations. And I'm like, okay, well, that's weird. Why is he doing this? It's obviously bullshit. He's having to respond. He's choosing to respond out of ethics, because if they don't respond, then that's
especially
bad.
Since the courts aren't open, so how would you sue them, for one thing?
Well, and I didn't say anything about courts. I demand to speak. I demand to talk to you or whatever. So I thought about that for a week, and I thought, okay, I'm going to leave that for a week, because that's weird. Why would the Attorney General reach out after 6 weeks and give me this information to send me down a rabbit hole, because I would never lose suing the government, right? And then I replied, and I probably shouldn't have, but this is what happened, is I said, okay, well, I'm on to you guys, and you're all going to be issued notices of liability at some point. I don't know how any of you sleep. You're all crooks. You've destroyed the economy, blah, 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 and I CC'd all of the cabinet. And you can just CC their email addresses. So someone's going to read it, right? They have to read all these emails. And I thought, well, you know, screw him, whatever. I probably won't hear back. Well, 2 weeks later, the first day the legislature opens, David Eby walks in, and the first order of business is Bill 19. He introduces this that will legally protect them all from any liability to do with what has happened. And it protects them all, particularly, that's Bill 19. It's called the COVID Measures Act. So I'm like, wow, I wonder if I was actually responsible for that. They might not have introduced this if I hadn't sent that email with the notice of liability. And I'm like, am I the they're person like, that actually caused that? It's really weird.
They're like the big pharma companies who back in the, as early as the 80s, you know, the American government brought in legislation where you couldn't sue big pharma. Now politicians are doing it too, which is kind of an admission of guilt, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the silver lining. It is. They are protecting themselves because they know what's coming. And so it's all good. We don't want Bill 19, but I always see the positive. And it's just really what so many of us are realizing. They operate like a cartel. Like, nobody got back to me and said, your voice is important. Can we speak to you on the phone? Of course we don't want injustice in British Columbia. Everybody ignored me. And that's how the government operates here now. It's us versus them. And they're going to do whatever they want.
Yep. Now, you've been leading protests as well,
reading.
I remember.
Yeah.
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 Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, just to
tell
finish up, Bill 19 has gone through three readings now, and it's going to royal assent. Okay, well, again, since I saw what was coming, I knew I was probably one of the first people in Vancouver or around the world. I was in this very early group of spotting this corruption, and I hadn't seen any civil disobedience about it, which was weird because we had just gone through 4 weeks of Unistotenment and Wet'suwet'en shutting down the rail yard. And so we were all on a bit of a high in terms of how we can actually be effective, right? That's what Wet'suwet'en and Unistotenen had done. They had effectively, on five continents, their movement had grown in less than 2 weeks. It was unbelievable. That was the fastest social justice movement I've ever seen in my life. And then, boom, Corona, the Wet'suwet'en stuff all stopped. And I'm like, this is high-level corruption. This is racketeering and organized crime. But nobody was doing anything. And I'm not someone who leads movements. I'm a designer. And I was like, well, I better get out there. But maybe it's me. Maybe it's my turn. Nobody else understands this corruption that I do. None of my friends know anything about infectious diseases. So I got sent out an email. Some groups responded and said, okay, there's a group coming. They're going to meet you. And April 12 was our first lawful protest march. And we had, under my leadership, we had 10 of them. And they're running the 14th one right now. It's happening right now in downtown Vancouver. And we were called the No More Lockdowns Vancouver Lawful Protest March Group. So now that the lockdown has really eased, a lot of people have stopped coming and think, well, things are going to be fine now. We don't know whether they will, but everyone's trying to figure out, okay, well, how do we reorganize and how do we pursue legal action or things that will protect us from the next stuff that's coming?
That's a topic for a whole show.
What to do. Yeah.
I'd like you back sometime soon. You can have a whole show about this, different measures people can take. Deb, do you have questions or comments?
Well, I found it interesting too that you mentioned that this, you saw right away that this is high level, that this is racketeering, that all of that is there. So then when you said we don't know if this is going to come back, my first thought was, if it's that high level, it's going to come back. There's definite phases. I mean, once there is an agenda and there's something that is being pushed towards, so I think to assume that something else is going to be coming around again is a safe assumption. And right now we've got time to have that breathing room to continue with the protests or continue, you know, like preparing. And I'm not saying it's this inward preparation and it's also an outward preparation too, is like really take time to see, since there's still feeds on the computer and we have access to things to get educated, to listen to the programs like this, and give yourself more of that sovereignty. And then also consider yourself an advocate. I mean, honestly, I like the way you put that, Sue, is that, you know, you, an advocate, speak up, and we can all be advocates. And that's actually really appeals to me.
Well, it's my business model, essentially. I've been working on this for a year or so, thinking, oh, I think other people will be interested in being involved with justice in a small way. I had no idea that Corona was coming. And now that's what I'm seeing. And I focus on educating and helping women. Women all over the world are getting off the couch, and they're getting out there. And they're the best advocates because they build communities. They talk all the time to everybody. They're natural activists. Women are mostly activists.
Right.
They're always the big numbers in the group. And we're also some of the most powerful people in society because we control the spending for our households, for our children. We buy the cars. You can't mess with women and mothers for very long until your business goes sideways, and this is all about money. And if we all stop vaccinating our children and we stop you know, whatever the financial rewards are of this industry, the pharmaceutical industry, it's going to hit their bottom line. So that's one of the most powerful things we can do. And you probably both know the story of apartheid, but we can't bankrupt the sector. And a lot of this will go away. Like, I think I follow the financial analysts who talk about the pharmaceutical industry, you know, and they're watching the trends in the public. And I think we're going to start seeing that over the next few months. The analysts are going to say, well, I don't know if these vaccines are such a good investment anymore because less people want them. It's going to take longer than they thought. The costs are going up. And investors aren't loyal. You know, as soon as they see any risk to their capital, they'll pull it out. And that's the best thing that could happen, is that the average person and the stockbrokers and the analysts start pulling money out of these vaccine companies. Because then this whole thing will collapse.
People have power. People do have
power. That's something we can all do.
That's what we always have to show people all the time. Yeah, for sure.
These are big public companies, and you can divest.
Yes. Well, like apartheid, the whole anti-apartheid movement was based on that. Any final words? I want to have you back soon, but any final words or websites or anything you want to share?
Well, my website is healthandjustice.site. It's just kind of a static thing. There's not a lot of excitement there because I'm too busy raising my kids this summer who need my full-time attention. But yeah, I would just say, in terms of for anybody, for them to do, is literally yourself or with a couple of friends, get out there and start doing something. Start making some phone calls, knock on doors, because the activism does work. When you push against these big corrupt systems, like what happened to me, I pushed Horgan and Ebby, and look what they did. Granted, we didn't want Bill 19, but there's a lot more success that happens with activism than people realize, and the less we just complain about it on Facebook, the better. The more we actually get out there and act as responsible people in our communities, living and exercising our human rights, the more we're going to get them back.
Absolutely.
It's like the simplest
Brilliant,
thing
Sue.
You can
Thank
do.
You.
Okay. Well, thanks for having
Thank
me
you,
on this wonderful day.
Sample. I want to have you back very soon. Thank you so much, Sue.
Yeah, anytime. Anytime. Okay, take care.
Bye for now. That was Sue Stanfield speaking from Vancouver. And it's a delightful story because I grew up in Kitsilano up by UBC. And the people who hang around those yacht clubs and that, they're kind of like the upper crust. And it's so hilarious imagining, you know, their little bourgeois environment being disturbed by this troublemaker, you know. I just got to laugh when I heard about that. But anyway, that was inspiring, and we'll have Sue back. Now, moving right along, Deb. any comments or anything you wanted to say?
Oh, you know what? I am really excited that she was leading this show out today. She's got a lot of information, and it felt really inspiring to me, because sometimes we really do get caught up in this a version of I don't know what to do, and you put your hands in the air, and just some of the things that she was mentioning really echoes a lot of what you're saying too. So it's really it was really a powerful one. I think you should get her back on the show. She was fun.
Yeah, and you know, it fit in so well with the whole notion of, well, resistance. What does it mean when we say resist tyranny? Mm-hmm. What tactics and strategy work? And she's absolutely right that one person can have a real impact if you're vocal in public all the time and kind of weaning
Absolutely.
People off the internet and putting them back into their communities. So let's talk about this whole thing about resistance. Yeah.
I'd like to. In fact, I wanted to, going from one interview into another one, I've got to say that today I actually watched this amazing interview that you had with Sean Atwood. It's on YouTube, and it was part two. So you've done a two-part interview with Sean Atwood, and so I was listening to this this interview that you gave him today, and really informative. It was pretty amazing. But I was also following the chat box on the site, and there was this question that I noticed that came up that I thought was a great question, and it was not asked to you, so I wanted to actually ask you if you would address it. The question was, are people born evil, or do they become evil? So I'm wondering if you would have something to say about that, because really what we're addressing is something that is definitely evil. So what would be your thoughts on that question?
That's a real question. And now, this is not an abstract question. People confront this every day. Like, why do people do things that are wrong and seem to get away with it. Sue was saying, why do no politicians respond anymore? They're just hammering us and ignoring public opinion. Well, the reality is, I think that it isn't just that people are made bad by systems, because you put anyone in a system of corruption and hierarchy, and they tend to act the way these politicians act. But there's something deeper going on, and that's what we like to explore in this show, right? And that something deeper has to do with the fact that, yes, I think there are people that are born deficient, more capable of committing evil against, you know, their fellow human beings. And by evil, let me be really specific about this. It means willing destruction of the innocent. That's my best definition. Not just an act of nature, but anyone or anything that goes out to willfully, deliberately destroy innocence, whether it's children, whether it's the innocence of our inborn liberty and sovereignty, all of that, deliberately go out to destroy it. And some people are more disposed to do that. But the weird thing about this culture is that it tends to select for those kinds of people. You know how Darwin had this theory about natural selection, how the fittest animals in nature tend to survive because they're best adapted to their environment. Well, what's really horrible about the culture we're in is that it selects culturally, not naturally, but it culturally selects the most ruthless individuals to rise up quickly through the systems of power. So that the ones at the pinnacle of government or church or corporations or military or big whoever, they tend to be the ones without any conscience, right? So psychopaths tend to be selected. They tend to rise to the top of these institutions. And so appealing to them is pointless because they don't understand what you're talking about. They laugh at you when you talk morality, right? And I experienced that Well, and you know from personal experience, surviving cult ritual torture in the Mormon church, that it's in these churches where that's most epitomized. You know, they hide behind religion, this evil reality.
They propagate it through the religion, not just hide behind it. In fact, you're talking about this selection process, and there was a very real selection process that I went through when I was 5 years old. And the sickening part of it, the part that really bothers me is, you know, as a child, children, if you watch children at play, they will definitely show you their personalities. You know, the ones that are more timid, the ones that have some leadership things, the ones that are creative, they sing a lot, or the ones that are angry, the ones that shut down, don't want to, I mean, you don't have to do anything other than have children in a room and they will naturally be who they are. And that's what, I don't know, when I look back on my stuff, sometimes I just get really angry, like beyond rageful actually, because that selection process that I was a part of, we were being filmed, and the ruse was, come be on this television show. We want to actually have her on this television show, and my mom thought that was a great idea. So they're filming all of these children, and they take that film, and then they watch the children, and I was selected, among other ones, but I know for me, I was selected by a particular leader in the church, Tom Monson, to be one of his. I was his. And so there was, when I would be delivered to church office buildings, and I was with him in his office, under his desk, whatever it is, and I was always given candy. Before that, it was always drugged and that kind of thing. But, you know, and that's more of my story. But the selection process is part of this. And we as people responding to the coronavirus, responding to the riots, responding, we are showing ourselves very, very clearly on who we are and who we're not, and what we respond to and what we don't, and where do we fall in this? And we're giving them all kinds of data. We're also giving ourselves data. You know, who am I in this? And where, you know, how do I address this? And so you mentioned that, you know, there's this a mass psychosis, and so I'm going to ask you again. It's like the selection we are all part of this. We're born into this battle. We're born into it already, so we're not really aware of it.
Exactly.
So how do you define psychosis? I mean, what do you mean by this, a group psychosis?
Well, leading into that, answering one of the things you were saying is, yes, we're all being experimented on. Yes, we're all being studied to see how effective the conditioning is taken. And the reason that's going on is, like what we talked about, in the hierarchical corporate structure, the most psychotic people are at the top. and everyone is expected, it filters down, the madness filters down, everyone's supposed to go ahead and be like them too. But psychosis is very simple. It's when you're so detached from reality that you created an imaginary world and you live in it. And group psychosis is everyone is sharing the delusion, right? So, for example, classic example, you walk into a public place and they say, put on your mask. And the very fact that you're not even wearing it means you're an enemy all of a sudden to them. Not because they're projecting onto you their own unresolved stuff, which psychotics do all the time. They need constant enemies because they feel that they're being victimized, right? Sociopaths are like that as well. Like they're always the victim, narcissistic personalities. Well, we live in a totally narcissistic culture. So anyone who's integrated and sane is an immediate threat. You're like a germ and the antibodies go after you. And spiritually and politically and every other way, that's exactly what we face. So there's a lot to be learned. Wilhelm Reich, Sigmund Freud, they all wrote on group delusion, mass psychosis. And people should start to do some background reading on that because that's exactly what we're immersed in. And it again raises the point, how do you resist that? Well, that's what I'd like to talk about with you for the next 20 minutes about we resist it, first of all, by knowing what it is, that it isn't simply political repression. They feed off each other. The psychosis leads to repression, which leads to psychosis, et cetera, right? But the question is, how do you break that? You break it by not being like it and by creating an alternative to people, by staying sane and saying, look, back to basics. They violated the rule of law. There is no democracy. There's no government or courts operating. Then we have to create it. That's the idea of the common law courts and assemblies and republic. We're reclaiming what we have allowed to be taken from us. And that's kind of in a nutshell, right?
Well, I mean, the other question, though, as you're saying this, since we're born into this and the psychosis, I don't know that we see it clearly. So, you know, we often don't see the agenda.
Right.
We see effects of it or the it's going to be really apparent once it like explodes itself onto the scene, and then we really kind of go into our own reactive mode, obviously. But how do we see clearly if we can't see the agenda, or if we don't necessarily or can't identify the effects because they are so gradual? What do we do then?
Well, that's the point, and I think that's a very real question because most of the people I work with are in that place. They know there's something wrong, and yet they don't really see what it is. They have their own theories about what it is, and there's a million theories circulating on the internet. I would say the most important thing for people to do is turn off the internet. Because don't forget, that device, like a television, was specifically designed for mind control. Like in television, interesting fact, in 1952, only 1 out of 100 Americans had a television set. 2 years later, by 1954, 1 in 2 had them. So it went from 1% to 50% of the population having the tube. And if you study what happens when you're looking at the television signal, your brain is put into an alpha wave state. And that's the state when you're just waking up or going to sleep. You're open to suggestion. It's not the beta wave, which is when you're fully alert and conscious, right? So they put the whole population to sleep to program them. That's exactly the time in period when the MKUltra experiments were going on. Television was a huge MKUltra mind control experiment. It's even more ramped up with the technology now. Minds, human brain waves are modulated directly by the internet, by iPads, by everything. They can be pumping any subliminal message to you and you won't even know it. And half the population of the planet is plugged into that or more.
Right.
So
right.
We don't know what is being broadcast, and for that reason alone, we need to turn it off. Use it for occasional emails and that, but do not rely on it as some kind of source of, not just information, but emotional comfort and vision and all that shit that people rely on for. We've got to get back to controlling our own minds, and you don't do that through the internet.
No, you're not. But because you're on this, it would be great to have some practical suggestions because it isn't. I would propose that it's a really desirable state to be in, that alpha brainwave. I work a lot with clients and people in meditation and accessing memories and things like that because of my own experience. And that's what we go after. We actually go into a space that is an alpha brainwave because there's so much information that we contain within ourselves that we can actually bring forward. So then if we're getting our information from this source, you know, the internet and our phone devices and other things that are really, they're fantastic at putting us in the cattle chute and taking us to the destination that they want us to be at, and we're just kind of mindless with it. You know, I would think that really a great alternative would be to turn that off, walk in nature, turn it off, and just sit and breathe and kind of get into that alpha place where you really want to be. You want to have that deep breathing relaxation anyway, and you don't need a device to get you there.
No, let me clarify. The alpha wave state that puts you in mechanically is very different than the natural alpha wave state. And in fact, it's a proven, it's a scientific fact that the energy frequency of the Earth is a very low frequency. It's identical to the natural frequency of the human brain. We're in the same natural wavelength as Mother Earth. And you knew that if you just go lie down on the grass for a while, you just feel suddenly calm and integrated and whole and wonderful, right? And
that's
one of the reasons Agenda 2030, the mandatory forced urbanization of the whole world's population, they've got to cut that off from us. So that's our first line of resistance. We turn off the machines, go back to the earth, meet neighbors. That's what we do in our common law assemblies. We sit and meet with neighbors. We're not going to distance. The only thing we're going to distance ourselves from is from tyranny, right? And so, you know, we start there. And we can use the information, but just use it very selectively off the internet and find other means. That's kind of where resistance begins. But, I mean, of course, it's more than that. And let's talk a little bit about, I mean, the big fact is that there's no lawful authority right now. Governments and courts are all closed. So there's an enormous opportunity here. There's a huge power vacuum. And no one has any authority over anyone else because none of it's lawful. So we need to create that authority. We do it within ourselves, but around us as well. And that's the exciting thing about this time we're in, is that it's not really bad in the sense that it's given us an opportunity to reclaim our lives. And we need a shock to wake up to this, and we're getting it.
Yeah, it is. And I suspect because of the shutdown, I know plenty of people, even myself included, that slowing down, you know, did a number on of favor, actually favored a lot of things with people. I don't know that there's many people that are wanting to go back to the crazy routine of 9 to 5 or of traffic or anything. I mean, honestly, if the corporations and the businesses and everything came up with solutions of how you could work at home, I would suspect there's a plenty of people that are like, you know what, this isn't that bad. I prefer this, you know? And what does that look like? Because it's a self-governing, if you're home, you know, you can actually determine a lot of other things, you know, just even to much, you know, like more so than when you get to take your break, but where do you take that break? Can you walk out to your backyard? Can you play with your dog? It's really, I think it's a really powerful thing that I would love to see kind of, you know, like ride that wave a little further. Say, no, I actually don't want to go back to the norm. I don't want to go back to anything. I want to create forward. I love the fact that you brought up the idea of going out and laying on the earth. And it reminded me of something that I was listening to a meditation this morning about water. And we're talking about resistance, and I've been making this very interesting. We kind of talked about this idea of, you know, resistance and yet power. And I think a lot of times, at least even for me, the idea of resisting instantly translates into experiences I've had previously where I had to get very defensive and stand with my fist clenched and get rigid and get, you know, like, I'm not saying strong, I am saying defensive, and there's a fear that comes behind that. And so I was just kind of curious because I remembered what you had said about Sun Tzu saying, you know what, you want to really work with that chi, and I love working with that those kinds of energies in the chi, but absorbing that energy or that frontal assault that comes from your enemy. So how, it felt like water to me. It felt like kind of a thing, and I wanted to ask you about that. Like, how do we be fluid in our movements, formless with what it is we're having to conform to, and yet be like as powerful as water? Would you tell me what you think about that?
Yeah, well, that's really key to this whole notion of strategy and battle. Like, we're in a battle now. People are waking up to that fact. And the way you learn about what you're really up against is not in the abstract. You don't get it by reading about it. You get it by engaging with an adversary. You learn what you're fighting by fighting it, right? One moment of experience in with the real system is worth 100 hours of reading about the, in the abstract about things. So you have to engage with the enemy, but the way you engage is on your terms, which means you're fluid in your movements. You don't respond to what they're doing. You move around them like water. And by doing that, even though you're small, you compel your enemy to defend against you at every point. So you dissipate their energy by being fluid. If you're standing out there with a sign saying, hi, here I am, screw you, bang, they can take you out. But if you do the unpredictable and you maneuver and you appear where they don't expect you to appear, you know, we proved that in bringing down these churches and exposing genocide. That's exactly what we did. We showed up when we weren't expected and where we weren't expected. And that way you dissipate the enemy's strength and you strengthen yourself because you're learning, but you're not revealing where you are, right? And in other words, you have to be formless, right? Your principles have to be solid, but how you attack and move has to be very strategic. I remember there was a quote from a community organizer, Saul Alinsky. He said, when you're poor, when you're one of the have-nots, the only thing you have is the people around you and your own experience. So 90% of what you do has to be creative, 10% routine. And that outdoes your enemy because a big corporation, they're completely routine. They have no creativity. They have a set way to respond to you, and you can outmaneuver them all the time. So that's kind of, in general, the approach. We have to be very fluid in how we approach any notion of resistance. And and hell, have fun doing it at the same time, because, you know, it's so easy. These people are so vulnerable. They're so easy to mock and expose. They expose themselves all the time. And so we have to be, you know, creative in how we go about it.
Well, I want to refer back to water. I like that you were saying what you were saying about that. But the thing that was really kind of struck me as I was comparing the two here is that, you know, as water flows, It does flow around, but it doesn't choose to flow backwards. It's not interested in going back and really just kind of fighting against what the was is. It's kind of like, well, there's the stone, there's the rock, but we're going to flow around this and continue on, and they don't know what to do with this because that is acting like the wild card in the deck. They do have an agenda, and they are we as world populations have been being studied. The stuff that we're working on here, you have said so many times, this is blowback from all of the experimentation that was being done on the Indian children. And this is also the same blowback that was being, the experimentation being done on me, stuff that was done in Nazi Germany to the Jews. This is the culmination of combining all of that research. So they do have a really good idea. There is a great idea of how people are going to respond to different stimulus. And we're going to show up for that. So being this way and actually moving and continuing with our movements is not what is expected, because most people either stand and fight, or they're going to like retract or whatever it is. I mean, there's dozens of things that we do, and they are planning on those. They're banking on those reactions.
Yeah, well, that's why the basic rule is never do what your enemy expects you to do. Once you do that, you're finished, especially when you're small. So, you know, you don't go into the courts. Like, I had a guy who was talking to me the other day in Ontario, and he said, you know, I've learned that you can't go into the courts. So what he's doing now is the first thing, he'll walk into a Crown Court in Canada, and now they're not even open. So he stands in front of a TV camera, right? This is constitutes a court now, a camera. And so what he says is, well, I'm not speaking to a human being. Can somebody tell me who you are behind this camera? And, you know, they get all bureaucratic and say, what's the name, number of your case? And he says, also, I'm being addressed by something called the Crown. Who is the Crown anyway? Can you answer that question? Who is the Crown? So he kept at that, and eventually they just turned the camera off and they told him to leave, because he was going outside their experience. And you've got to always do that. Always go outside the experience of who you're facing, right? That's bottom line.
Yeah, well, I think Susan's example about, you know, doing something different was a great example. You know, she started out with the email. I was really key. It was interesting to me that she says, well, first off, I got ignored. And I thought, you know what, here in Salt Lake, there was a very real experience where a gentleman named Sam Young wanted to make a point, and he did something outside the box. and did a peaceful fast. And he was constantly inviting church leaders to come and meet with him so that they could address what he was wanting to bring attention to. And they did the same thing. They ignored him. And it, for me, it was no surprise. I'm like, yeah, he's small potatoes to these guys because I know them. I know how they're viewing this. I know what's going on in this thing. And so, you know, it's like, well, eventually he'll go away. And I actually, what he did is he did affect some change later on. A few months later, there were some changes made in church policies that really kind of did address it, didn't fully address it, but he did do something outside the box, you know? So what you're saying right. is really powerful. Your examples too.
Yeah. And you know, that's the thing that when you're talking to people, the first difficulty when you're suggesting doing something different is it isn't even a question of, is this legal? Are we going to get into trouble? It's more basically, am I able to do this? Not in mm-hmm. terms of somebody else, but in terms of myself. Yeah, do I have it within me to take this action? Because I've never even thought in these terms. And, you know, we always ask, you know, we know what the external problems are. It's obvious to everybody now. But what is it in ourselves that is allowing this crime to continue? And the way we are trained to be complicit from a young age, the idea of saying you don't have to be anymore, you can go your own way, you're a free and sovereign man or woman, that's such a new idea to people. It takes them acclimatizing. And that's why we say, look, let's have a workshop, let's talk about it, let's have role-playing, let's go try something in the real world and see what happens. Try things all the time. You can't do that on your own. You need to do it with other people and try it out first, right?
Well, you've got a lot of experience even recently with people asking you to come and do some workshops and gather and educate. And, you know, I know that what you've come up against, too, is that exact thing where people are very eager to step in. And then not too much longer yeah. or after that, then I think you've noticed that some people kind of fall away. And I would love for you to speak to that because that's a real issue. I mean, I think what happens is people look at the idea that they have to resist means a particular definition in their mind and they can't measure up to, or they choose not to risk that definition. And so to change right. that definition, that perspective is important. So what have you noticed?
Well, resist is a word that gets people scared for sure. Gandhi got around that by using the word non-cooperation. We're not going to cooperate. And that gives people a sense of their own power more. Resist, you think, oh, you mean I have to fight these people? Don't forget in the whole that this saying of Jesus that's always quoted, do not resist evil. You translate the word resist into from his Aramaic and the Greek that it was translated into in the New Testament. And it means do not be like your enemy. Doesn't mean don't oppose them. It's say the way you oppose them is not to be like them. And then you walk in a different direction, and that's doing what Sun Tzu says when you reclaim the chi. You're creating your own sphere of energy, and they've got to come into yours. Like, they've got to come into our courts now. Always think in terms of how we create that. Again, that's a new idea for people because we're taught to be always deferring to something or someone else outside ourselves. God, you know, a ruler, a law. It's mm-hmm. always outside ourselves. Mm-hmm. And the idea that it can come from within. You know, the kingdom of heaven is within us. You know, that's a pretty radical idea, but it's a time, it's an idea whose time has come, because more and more people are realizing this. We just have to be the spark to awaken people to that. And we've had successes in that. It goes up and down. For every 3 common law assemblies we form, 2 will collapse, but 1 carries on. You know, it's like a constant struggle. It's like the tide coming in and out, but that's life. You know, it's constant yeah. change and conflict, and we've got to adapt to and orient to that all the time, that it's change and it's fluid, like we said, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely, which is another reference to water. I mean, it adapts, but it also creates change. It cuts through where it is. I mean, I was thinking about how, you know, water's contained and there's a dam, and those dams have to be, like, massive to hold back the pressure of what the yep. water naturally wants to do, which is evolve. We are evolving evolutionary beings, right. organisms. We're not amoebas. Honestly, we have moved ourselves forward, and that is with some, you know, like we come up against something we don't like, we don't understand, yes. we don't care about, whatever, and we push through that into something new, which is going to be uncomfortable. Right. And I think the idea of reframing some things, like you know, you and I were talking about me being a victim, and you mentioned, you know, I prefer the word veteran, and my shoulders went back and I stood a little straighter, and I'm like, hell yeah, I'm a veteran. I've been through this, but I'm not weakened because of this. And if people like
right.
the idea of
Beautiful.
Being revolutionaries over being a resistance, then go with revolutionary. Yeah. It's
30
it's
seconds here.
That I totally see that. Oh yeah, no, I'm just it's reframing so that you can understand you better to continue your evolution and your movement forward.
That's a beautiful example. I want to carry on with that next week. We're veterans, not victims. And we're going to end on a wonderful song here. It was a great show. Thank you, Deb, and thank you, Sue.
Thanks,
The Minstrel
Kevin.
Boy, it's about how we have to fight and not be slaves. This is from the land of my ancestors, The Minstrel Boy. Follow our work, republicofcanada@gmail.com, murderbydecree.com. Stay strong, stay clear. We're back live next week. Thank you all.